Carl Safina is with Bill Russell and me. I am Paula Gordon here on the Paula Gordon Show. There was a time when people who had taken to the sea looked at the albatrosses and they tell stories about them and stuff, but they really didn't know very much. And the things that you are describing are not just Carl Safina thinks this. This science has really begun, humans who do the science work, to learn about how these sea creatures work. And you talk at great length about banding the albatrosses. So you really know where Bill's girlfriend Amelia went. And things that seem really quite implausible, but we are beginning to really know things about the seabirds, are we not?
People have been banding birds for quite a few decades, and that tells you a lot of things. It doesn't tell you really much about how they travel, although you might find a bird somewhere and know that it originated somewhere else. But in the 90s, primarily, new technology where you could put a satellite transmitter on a bird. Now they have these GIS systems that they can actually place on birds, and you can let a bird go and just sit in your laboratory following its movements around on a daily basis and knowing not only the point A and point B part, but every point in between, how it travels, how it lingers, how it hurdles onward in its sprints from one place to another. And we've started to understand a lot about how a lot of different animals use the ocean for the first time in the last 10 years with certain kinds of birds and certain kinds of big fish.
Some of the people who have this passion also have a passion for sharing it. One of the scientists of whom you speak in Eye of the Albatross not only has put the transmitters on the birds, then he's sent that information not just to his lab in New Jersey or wherever it is, but also to school children all over the world who can follow the Amelias. That too is kind of a surprising expansion of what the sciences are doing, isn't it?
Right. That was Dave Anderson of Wake Forest University in North Carolina, and I thought it was really wonderful that he put all this information up on a website and specifically sent it to subscribing classrooms in quite a few countries, so that every day as he was getting the new information, instead of jealously hoarding it until he could publish it and get all the credit, he shared it with everybody, and then he published it and got all the credit anyway, as was his due. But that's what science is supposed to do. It's supposed to help us all understand the world, and some scientists sort of forget some of that at times, but he did a really, really nice job of that.
Well, and you also talk, I know, Bill, you want to talk too. You also talk about all the different kind of scientists that come together on these breeding ground islands. Some are there for turtles, and some are there for seals, and some are there for the birds. But that sense of a collaboration and that the physical spaces draw lots of different kinds of scientists, that also seems to have some effect on the kinds of stories that we can tell each other and learn more about.
Well, just like those birds come from thousands of miles away to those isolated little islands to breed, they have scientists who come from thousands of miles away to study their breeding there. But and science was very confined by studying only the breeding part of their lives and not understanding anything about what happened in between. But more recently, with all these little devices that you can put on animals to actually see what they're doing, how far they're going, how deep they're diving, if they happen to be things like seals. And people have learned really, really a lot in you know, the last decade or two of things that we had no idea before. You would see an albatross in the middle of the ocean, but you would have no idea why it was there or that it was connected to an island thousands of miles away where there was a chick waiting for it to bring. People just assumed that those albatrosses out there were not nesting. And you may see a seal on the beach and think, oh, what a wonderful life. You just lie around on the beach all the time. And now we know that they may spend weeks going hundreds of miles from shore and diving thousands of feet to find food and experiencing a change in the environment from the surface to where they're looking for food that would utterly destroy a human body. And that's just their way of eating.
We talk a lot now about globalization and about people becoming citizens of the world, and we're pretty, I think, self-impressed by that. And in some ways, it's a very impressive phenomenon. One of the things that struck me, I was reading another book more or less on that subject.
Globalization.
On globalization. At the same time, I was reading your manuscript, and I was struck that, you know, what we're so proud of, the albatross has been doing for millennia, perhaps millions of years, literally all over the world, or at least the four-fifths or three-quarters, depending on who's counting, of the part that is water. And it somehow or other is humbling to realize that this essentially very small creature, they long wingspan, but they don't weigh a lot, has the capacity and has in fact been pretty much all over the world in places that for a long time, humans couldn't go. We didn't have the technology. And it's just, again, it's humbling.
The migrations of birds, although I focus on albatrosses and I focus specifically on one particular albatross called Amelia, who was wearing a satellite transmitter, but you can find birds that are much, much smaller who, although they don't travel as far on a daily basis over the course of the year, they go from one end of the earth to the other and back, and they may weigh an ounce or a few ounces.
That's unbelievable.
But that's the phenomenon of bird migration, and no matter where you are, at any moment, there are billions of birds moving incredible distances across the face of the planet.
I can sort of see somebody out there saying, so what? Why should I care?
It's just a very fascinating part of how incredibly rich this world is, and the tremendous biological endowment that we have, and knowing about that makes my life much, much more interesting and enjoyable. And
I'm gonna challenge you on that, because I think that there's a much bigger so what. I think that if we don't have some investment in all of this, that we're likely to kill it.
Well, it's true that we're killing a lot of things that very few people even realize are disappearing, and I think that that's the great hazard and the great shame of it as well, because while to me a lot of this diminishes life tremendously, other people don't feel any loss because they were never so enriched as I have been blessed to be enriched just because I happen to learn about these things. And then, of course, the hazard is you get to a certain spot where you start losing the things that really matter as far as supporting life on the planet. And we're definitely getting close to those places, and we're starting to affect things that do really matter as far as supporting life on the planet. But we've gotten into a habit of doing things as though there's nothing else out there that we're affecting, and ultimately we're gonna start affecting ourselves as well as destroying the lives of all these other creatures.
This sounds irrelevant, but I think it's part of the predicate to thinking about the albatross. It seems there are really two questions. Don't they get tired? And, you know, it's all well and good on a clear day to sail a kite or to sail an albatross, but one would think, I would have thought, that a hurricane, particularly the kinds of hurricanes that are, or not hurricanes, but the weather and all of its manifestations in the southern oceans, particularly around the places where the Atlantic and the Pacific run together, that nothing could be in the air under those circumstances except water and froth and air. And it's from a distance, it's not plausible that they don't get real tired and you know, just run out of energy, because it's, you know, flying presumably takes some energy, and that they aren't just ripped apart, or at least have found some way to
stay out of those places,
to avoid storms.
It's a matter of adaptation to what counts as home. There are some seabirds that are the more coastal seabirds that live in places that are calm most of the time that get killed in storms, and sometimes they get killed in storms in large numbers. There are other birds that live in the windiest places on Earth, and among them are a lot of albatrosses and petrels and smaller relatives of that group called storm petrels. And I have actually seen them in a storm that was so powerful that our 250-foot ship had to completely turn around and face the waves and the wind for about 22 hours. We were sort of paralyzed in this storm and at risk from the towering waves and the incredible strength of the elements, that there were albatrosses that were gliding straight into a steady 60-mile-an-hour wind, going forward in it without moving their wings. And there were little birds, little petrels and prions, that were not only withstanding it, but they were still feeding. And they were just down in the troughs, and they would pop over the tops of 40 or 50-foot waves and suffer a moment or two of being blasted by the wind, and they get down in the trough and were continuing to look for plankton and pick stuff out of the water. And that was just... It was just another day at the office for them.
Well, this is Carl Savino. And Bill, you can pick that right back up when we come back in a moment. Please be with us when we return.